Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Is that a Durham Bulls jersey?
It is indeed, my friend. Spring fever is among us. My Baltimore Orioles, my major league team, they just swept the Red Sox and the Twins. So I thought I would dust off some baseball stuff. Thank you for noticing, Bill. You don't often compliment me on my attire. I take it as a compliment.
So how was that shirt procured?
This came from, it was a gift, actually, from our friends, the Spateses, John and Christy Spates, my old friends. And John is a buddy from high school. Christy is a fabulous editor and also a great gift giver, because I feel like the Spateses maybe give the best gifts every year. I'm not sure that I'm keeping up my end of the bargain. I don't think they're getting Kevin Costner quality stuff in return.
Very exciting.
Bill, I need to, before we move on, I should congratulate you, since you know
what I do.
Oftentimes you are proven right eventually, but as you may or may not recall, last week, we kind of led the show talking about Donald Trump giving this abortion announcement where he was send it back to the states. Mm-hmm. And I argued that that was a smart move, mm-hmm. although we could criticize him for kind of lacking principle. Mm-hmm. I argued that it was politically sagacious and that it would be hard to pin him, as abortion has become a potent weapon for Democrats. It would be hard to pin that on Donald Trump. And Bill, like almost immediately, Arizona said, hold my beer. And the Arizona Supreme Court, reinstated this 1864 law. So it's been a whole week. It feels like that was a million years ago, but wanted to say.
Well, thank you. And I didn't even know this, I think, when we were talking about it. If I remember correctly, I think I ended up writing something about it after we talked. And when I was just researching where do things stand in all of the swing states, I saw that the following day was the deadline for the Arizona Supreme Court to rule on this case. So it was known that this was in the queue. And although I would suspect that the Cracker Jack Trump political team was not aware, they did not do their research on this. Considering that Trump says he's not for the 1864 total ban, you would think that he would say, well, let's see what they do in Arizona first before I go out there and make a big statement about how the states are going to do this brilliantly. Either he was aware and just rolled the dice, or just thought he could blow past it somehow, or he wasn't aware and got blindsided. Either way, I'm just sort of struck by the notion that Trump thinks he was smarter than all the other pro-lifers in how he was going to talk about this issue. You have to know how to talk about it. And all he has done is just stepped in it over and over again since he's talked about it.
And it's not just Trump, Carrie Lake, who's running for the U.S. Senate out there, Bill. She was vehemently and specifically in support of the 1864 law being reinstated until it happened. And now she is completely flip-flopped. And she put out an ad last week that could only be described as a pro-choice ad. I mean, it sounded like something Bill Clinton might have run in the 90s, safe, legal, and rare kind of rhetoric.
And she supported the 1864 ban in the gubernatorial campaign, and now she's flip-flopped on that. I mean, they're all right that that's not a good political position to have, but they all have compromised credibility on it because they've all been all over the map.
All right. Well, anyway, I just wanted to, kudos to you, Bill, because I was wrong. You were right. I thought that although I didn't respect what Trump was doing from a philosophical standpoint, I thought he was being sort of slippery politically. Mm-hmm. And at least in almost immediately, you were proven right that it was actually not a smart political move either.
No, it still remains to be seen if it's going to matter. You know, can Trump still not have this be the issue that November hinges upon? I mean, that's still an unknown.
Right, right. Well, a more pressing, at least for us this week, issue, I guess there are two, Bill. One is the trial, the hush money trial in New York for Donald Trump. And as we record this, they are impaneling jurors. They had seven. One of them just said, "I can't do this."
She got sort of called out. It's not maybe the best word, but Jesse Waters on Fox like highlighted her characteristics, and apparently, you know, enough that a whole bunch of people like flooded her phone, was like, "Is this you? Are you on the jury?" And like that seemed to be a factor in her saying, like, "This is, you know, I'm not in a good position to do this."
Yes. And I mean, we know of the seven, we know because there's 42 questions that they have to answer. And so, for example, the four person, used to be four men, I think, but the four person, for example, watches MSNBC and Fox News, according to the reporting. And so we know a little bit of something. We know that there are two lawyers among the seven or six now, and that's not usual. That normally lawyers who are involved in a trial don't like to impanel jurors who are lawyers. So we know a little bit about them, and it's possible that you could maybe figure out who some of these people are. And Bill, that could be potentially dangerous. I mean, we have Donald Trump now, who is violating a gag order, attacking the judge, attacking witnesses. And now we have his allies who are...
He shared Jesse Waters' stuff about the jury.
Yeah.
Other
guy, I don't know if you saw this, but Clay Travis, who's a prominent kind of right-wing guy, who's also a sports guy, he put out a tweet basically saying, "Hey, New Yorkers, if you're a Trump supporter, try to get on this jury so you can nullify it effectively." Right, right. So it's getting messy, and it could be dangerous.
Well, I wrote about this at the Washington Monthly today, and I would say that a lot of my analysis of the past several months in terms of the election has been favorable to Biden. I do think Biden is still in a good position, even though he's still behind in the polls, generally speaking. Ticked up. He's ticked up in national polling since State of the Union. I would still argue that, I've argued that I think the economy is going to be a net positive for him if we stay on this trajectory. I've argued that Trump's stepping on abortion. I am not an optimist about this trial. I'm not saying he can't be found guilty. I haven't been one to say this is somehow a trivial matter. That's not a real, that this is politically cooked up by Alvin Bragg. I'm not saying that. But you need a unanimous jury to convict him. And it just takes one secret Trump partisan to slip on. When you read about these descriptions of the jurors, like they read to me like one of these New York Times focus groups of low information voters where you read what they actually think. And it's also incoherent and irrational. Like your mind explodes. You can't believe these are the people that determine who becomes our elected leaders. That is why I feel this. I mean, I can't know this, of course. I'm only getting little whispers of information, but that is certainly my fear that we're not dealing with like the cream of the crop here on the jury. And who knows what they might do.
Well, because by definition, you'd have to be somebody. So right now, they interviewed 1,000 or more, maybe thousands of potential witnesses. And anybody who says they want off the jury, they're letting off. The judge is just, if you say like, "I don't want to do this, I don't think I can be fair," you're like, you're gone. So number one, we're self-selecting people who want to be on the jury, who maybe they have nothing better to do, or they find it interesting, or maybe they have a hidden agenda. And then these people can't have strong opinions. I mean, really, if even if you could be fair, if you say that you have a strong opinion, they will probably kick you off. So it is sort of self-selecting a certain type of person, right?
And I mean, look, I just came out of a grand jury experience, which is not the same thing. It's not as intense as being on a regular jury because you're not deciding, you know, actual guilt. You're deciding probable cause. You know, most things in front of you are pretty straightforward and not close calls as far as the probable cause standard is concerned. But I guess I can't say, you know, the group dynamic of a jury, you just can't know going in. Like what little we know now doesn't tell me what their internal deliberations are going to be like, who's going to be kind of the big talker, who's going to be the most persuasive, who's going to be is there a stubborn person that just can't be moved? Like all that stuff, I can't know. But the whole thing is designed to make it hard to convict people. The whole point is that you got to be 100%, as close to 100% as possible, no reasonable doubt. And people from all walks of life, all agreeing. It's a high standard, as it should be. So, if Trump walked, I wouldn't say like the system is rotten. But I'm just saying, don't hinge your presidential campaign strategy on assuming he's going to be found guilty. Because
are people criticizing Biden for not talking about this, or is this just your preemptive warning?
One, I think what we've seen of Biden in the past 48 hours, he is not basing his strategy on a guilty outcome. He is purposefully trying to do the split screen thing. We're going to talk about the issues and let the camera just drift over to Trump on its own, and you can see for yourself who's, you know, doing their best for America. So I think Biden's on the basic right track here. Just from what I've read from campaign reporters, it's not so much that they're presuming he'll be acquitted or there'll be a mistrial, just that they think they don't want to give fodder. They don't want to give Trump reason to say, oh, Biden's behind all of this. And they just feel like they don't need to put their thumb on the scale because it kind of speaks for itself. But I'm sort of adding to that. Like, you need to really make sure you are emphasizing things that contrast the two of them on the economy, on Ukraine, on abortion, on democracy, that you can say before the verdict and after the verdict in the exact same way. So you stay on your course and what happens in the trial doesn't affect your strategy.
I mean, look, if there's a hung jury or if he is found not guilty, depending on the timing, this could be like a James Comey type situation, right? Where like Trump looks vindicated and it actually helps him win the election, and it actually overshadows the other three upcoming trials, and frames it as it was all much ado about nothing. It's all just one big witch hunt. I mean, this is the stakes are high here.
I mean, obviously, if Trump was acquitted or there was a mistrial, you know, he would say things like that. He would certainly play the card as hard as he could possibly play it. Now, from what I understand, they were expecting a 6-week process here. But of course, we don't know, you know, we just lost the juror in a 24-hour period. We don't know how long the jury selection process is going to take. If there's going to be further juror problems down the line, they have to bring in alternates. There's all these gag order things going on. I mean, I'm not a legal analyst. I haven't been in a courtroom before. So I can't tell you what the likelihood of, you know, delays that could occur that would stretch this out. But from what little I know, I don't think it's going to go all the way to October.
Yeah, fair point.
This particular trial. So I think there's certainly room for Biden to be able to say, you know, whatever happens here, I got a whole bunch of things that make up my case that are irrelevant to this.
Yeah, and the way that things happen nowadays, if this is decided like in June or July, it'll be like a million things will happen between then and the election. But still, it would certainly be helpful to Trump and certainly not helpful to Biden. So the stakes are high. The other big thing happening right now is this motion to vacate, where Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie are threatening to try to oust Speaker Mike Johnson, apparently for the sin of he wants to fund Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, that kind of thing, foreign aid. I have some clips of Mike Johnson. I don't know if you've seen these, Bill. He's sounding tough, and he's sounding, dare say, Reagan-esque. But any thoughts before I roll a few of these?
Go for it. Let's go to the videotape.
Let's roll the tape. I've got three. The first two are from Jake Tapper. Let's go to the first.
We know what the timetable is. We know the urgency in Ukraine and in Israel. And we are going to stand by Israel, our close ally and dear friend. And we're going to stand for freedom and make sure that Vladimir Putin doesn't march through Europe. These are important responsibilities. A strong America is good for the entire world. Since World War II, really, the responsibility for the free world has been shifted onto our shoulders. And we accept that role. We're an exceptional nation. We're the greatest nation on the planet, and we have to act like it. And we have to project to Putin and Xi and Iran and North Korea and anybody else that we will defend freedom. It doesn't mean boots on the ground. We're not the world's policemen, but we're going to do the right thing. And I think the Congress is going to take an important stand.
All right. I'll just go ahead and play the second one here, and then we can talk. And then I'll play the third.
We understand. Look, I'm a child of the 80s. I regard myself as a Reagan Republican. I understand the concept of maintaining peace through strength. That's one of our guiding principles. It's a really important philosophy, and it's a big part of our party and our worldview. And I think here is an opportunity to make that stand at a really critical time in world history. I mean, there are global implications to what we do. So, look, everybody can grumble about details of the legislation. What are mine, my friends, and everybody you just showed are all good friends. Listen, we're not going to get 100% of what we want right now because we have the smallest majority in history, and we only have the majority in one chamber.
All right, what do you make of that, Bill?
I just want to add, I'm just looking on X right now. There are some of the congressional reporters are saying, Johnson having, this is Olivia Beavers who writes for Politico, Johnson having what looks like an intense convo with Representatives Gates, Perry, Burchett, Ogles, Donalds, and other House R's. Johnson just put his head in his hands and shook his head. He is surrounded by folks who have taken issue with his foreign aid plan. So, you know, this is happening in real time as we speak here. Johnson is trying to speak rationally to people who are pretty hell-bent on letting Ukraine get steamrolled. I mean, that's really what this comes down to here. We've discussed in the past whether, you know, Johnson, who voted against Ukraine aid in the past, been close to Trump, was just in Mar-a-Lago. But when you get into a leadership position, you know, that can change people in different ways. Some people meet the moment and some people don't. And like, there's obviously all sorts of ways that Mike Johnson, you know, rankles me. I don't agree with him on pretty much most everything. But he appears to be about to do the right thing here, knowing that it could mean the loss of his position. And I wrote about this in the Washington Monthly newsletter on Tuesday, and I'm doing a little mind read here. I don't know if this is what he's actually thinking, but I believe he's come to the conclusion, this job's not worth it. Like, I don't have to bend over backwards to cling to this job. It's not a great job. I'm just going to do what I'm not going to be held responsible for Putin taking over Ukraine just so I can like hold this gavel to do what? To be part of gridlock? What's the point of that? So no, I think he's made the right calculation here.
I do too. Either you win the right to be the speaker and to actually lead, or the job wasn't worth having anyway. But what I do think is interesting, Bill, from the rhetoric that we just heard, and I have another clip to play that he echoes some of these same points, I think that the Reagan worldview, kind of internationalist worldview, was so deeply embedded in the Republican Party for so many decades that it still is dormant in some cases, and it is reemerged. I think deep down, Mike Johnson, these ideas were kind of inculcated, you know, deep inside of him. And when push has come to shove, they're coming out. And that's going to be the problem that Trump has and MAGA has when they try to change the Republican Party and make it in Trump's image. They're going to keep running into people who are sending all the right signals that they're on board, but have down deep in them a conflicting set of values and principles. And every once in a while, whether it's Mike Pence or now Speaker Johnson, it's going to come out.
Well, you know, I was really struck that the other day Mike Johnson referred to himself as a Reagan Republican. And you and I talked about this when he first got the gavel. You know, what is Mike Johnson? Is he a Trump Republican or a Reagan Republican? We know he was voting in a Trumpy way as a backbencher, but that might have been just because that was the safe thing to do when you weren't in a leadership position. But the things that seem to have animated him before being Congress were social conservative issues and not so much, you know, these Trump America First type issues. And look, Mike Johnson is literally, you know, he and I were born the same year. He is 8 months older than me. You know, he watched Family Ties. He is an Alex P. Keaton, Ronald Reagan Republican. That is, I think he is more shaped by that worldview than the Trump worldview. He did what he had. He's doing what he has to do to try to best he can to stay in Trump's good graces, because that's who's leading the party right now. But I don't think that is what is in his DNA, and that is becoming impossible to cloak with the prospect of Russian taking over Ukraine staring at him in the face.
All right, let's play this clip. Now, this is, I think, the version I'm playing is from C-SPAN, but I think this was like a press conference or something he gave, you know, I do think it was planned, but he's going to be repeating a lot of the same talking points that he made to Jake Tapper, which to me just sort of reinforces that wasn't an accident. This is what he's doing.
I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do. I really do believe the intel and the briefings that we've gotten that I believe Xi and Vladimir Putin and Iran really are an axis of evil. I think they're in coordination on this. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Balkans next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of our NATO allies. To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. My son is going to begin in the Naval Academy this fall. This is a live fire exercise for me, as it is so many American families. This is not a game. It's not a joke. We can't play politics with this. We have to do the right thing. And I'm going to allow an opportunity for every single member of the House to vote their conscience and their will on this. And I think that's the way this institution is supposed to work. And I'm willing to take personal risk for that, because we have to do the right thing, and history will judge us.
I mean, that's he said everything he should have said there, right?
Yeah. And I'm trying to the line that he said that I thought was important. Oh, they believe the intel. You know, if you were a diehard MAGA before you went into this position and you're given these intelligence briefings, if you were not someone who was an open-minded person, you would go in saying, these intelligence guys are part of the deep state. I'm not going to believe one word they have to tell me. You know, I'm just going to block it out. And if he was MAGA before, if he was anti-deep state before, he's not now. He is telling Republicans, you should believe the intelligence. And that shows either growth or a reveal of where his, you know, true principles always lay. This gets into a little bit of a different discussion. Both parties have their divisions when it comes to foreign policy. Democrats are divided on Israel and Gaza. Republicans are divided when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. And I suspect that the division on the Republican side runs deeper than the division on the Democratic side. Because I think even on the Democratic side, people might have different degrees of sympathy to the Israeli government, but they pretty much all want a two-state solution. I mean, there are a handful like River to the Sea people out there, but generally speaking, they all want a two-state solution. I don't think there is that same level of overlap between the America First, Ukraine just give up land now, Republicans, and the Republicans like Mike Johnson are saying Ukraine needs to be fully armed to resist Russia. I don't think there's a lot of overlap there.
All right, Bill, well, before we call it a day, and I think we are going to try to keep it tight, but before we do that, we had a request from our pal Bill Buettler and his lovely wife, Shira, that we talk about Sonia Sotomayor, the Supreme Court Justice. As you probably know, Bill, there's been some pressure on her from pundits and Democrats to retire. And the theory is she's in her 60s. She's had some health issues. And right now, Democrats have the presidency and the Senate.
What are her health issues? Forgive me for being uninformed. Did she have a real significant health issue?
Something like diabetes or something. I don't want to talk out of turn. But I will say this. Nothing compared to Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah, that was a much different deal.
RBG was 18 years older. But that, you got to realize, Bill, and I'm sure you do, that is... that's on Democrats' mind, what happened with RBG. Should have retired when Obama was president. She thought Hillary was going to win, so she stuck around, and Trump ended up getting to pick her successor. So what do you say on this? How concerned are you?
I'm not super concerned. It's not the same situation as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who had a myriad of serious health problems, including cancer. Like, you knew she was pushing her luck the whole way through. I mean, on one hand, the relatively safe thing to do for anybody is to resign when your party has the presidency in the Senate. You might as well resign, no matter how long you've been there, just so somebody younger than you can get it and potentially stay there long. Like, that is just... you know, actuarially, the safe thing to do. Now, that doesn't mean that's always going to work out. You might put someone younger than you, ends up getting colon cancer and dies when they're 52, or they get hit by a bus. Like, you can't know for sure ever if the odds are going to work out in your favor. So I'm sort of reluctant to treat this as there's one dead obvious thing to do and one dead obvious, you know, terrible thing to do here. And if you don't resign, you're obviously being selfish, because it's not that perfect. So she is 69. She has type 1 diabetes. She travels with a medic. But as I saw one comment mention, her mother lived to be 94. So it's not like her genes are necessarily predisposed to her dying early. But again, who knows? I mean,
yeah.
But here's the diabetes other question, is not late stage cancer, so it's not quite the same thing.
Well, the other question is, you know, the Senate is so narrowly divided right now, right? And you've got Kristen Sinema, who's an independent. You've got Joe Manchin, who could go rogue. There's really no guarantee that Biden could get a nominee through, even with a Democratic. Ostensibly a Democratic Senate right now.
I mean, it is a risk. I would think he will probably be able to get somebody through. Like Manchin recently said, I'm not going to vote for any judge for the rest of my time here, which is running short, unless they have support from a Republican. So they at least have some nominal bipartisan element to it for him to vote for. He's not going to vote for on a party line vote. And presumably, that way, unless you're going to pull Collins or Murkowski, your probably Manchin would be off the table if he was maintaining that standard for a Supreme Court justice. Now, Sinema has not really broken ranks when it comes to judges, so I don't think she would do that. But she also doesn't have to answer to anybody right now. She's not even up for. She's leaving the Senate too. She certainly could say to Joe Biden, "You need my vote. Don't nominate this person, nominate that person."
Yeah.
So you certainly can't assume that Biden's going to get like a really robust liberal justice. You might get a justice that is not as liberal as Sotomayor.
What about Merrick
Garland? Current circumstances.
Merrick Garland could be the guy, right?
Or someone of that ilk. You know, Sinema could try to throw her weight and insist on somebody like that. So there's nothing perfect here. It is totally inexcusable that Ruth Bader Ginsburg didn't retire when Obama was president, but before Republicans took over the Senate. She should have known better. You know me, Matt. I'm not ageist. I do not think Pelosi should be forced out. I don't think Biden should be forced out. This is different because it's lifetime appointments that don't come up very often with an immense amount of power. And when you were that old with that many health ailments that she had, should have known better. Sotomayor is not quite in the same boat. I get the argument. I'm not saying it's a ridiculous argument, but you can't say it's a totally airtight argument because there's always degrees of uncertainty here.
No, I get your point about it. Sounds to me like you do not want to push out Sonia Sotomayor. You do not think it's appropriate to pressure her to get out based on the conditions.
I mean, someone's supposed to be this stupid because, like, you can't force her out. It is her decision. The Senate should be demanding this. Well, they can't make her do anything. I mean, Obama did talk to Ginsburg. It's like he didn't try. But it was her call. It's Sotomayor's call.
My question is, with that being true, obviously, would you prefer, would you feel safer? Do you think it's a safer bet for Democrats for her to retire today? Or is it a safer bet just strategically for her to stay put?
I mean, yeah, obviously there's not a perfectly plausible situation where Trump is president and the Republicans take the Senate. So you can't feel very good about, the next 4 years. But I'm not super concerned that she's going to die in the next 4 years. And who knows where things look at beyond that. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there. Would I say it's like a 55-45 case she should retire? Yeah. She should probably recognize that, like, she can still have like a plenty good life, post-Supreme Court. It doesn't feel like her life is ended if she did retire and she did good while she was there. But if she really enjoys the gig and is deriving a lot of personal satisfaction from it, I get why she would want to stay.
All right. Well, there you go, Butlers. Please hit up our Patreon. We took a request.
And I didn't get your take. What do you think she should do?
I say batten down the hatches. I say stay put. I feel like she's resilient. I don't know what risks could be involved in her leaving. Like the it doesn't seem to me to be a slam dunk that this goes smoothly.
I'll say one other thing that I probably shouldn't say, Matt.
Okay. That's the best kind of comment.
The worst thing, pretty much the worst thing the Supreme Court could do, they already did. They already nuked Roe. Like, that was the thing that people were most afraid about. I mean, obviously, you could go, I guess, one step worse, a court that Trump handpicks who ends democracy, that allows elections to be stolen. Like, that, maybe that's worse. But I'm not super concerned about that. So the gamble that Sotomayor is taking by staying, I think, is less of a substantive gamble than the gamble Ruth Bader Ginsburg took and lost. It's hard to, I mean, obviously, you can invade, they could take away gay rights or do something on transgender rights. I'm not saying horrible things can't happen. That was the biggie, and they did it. And even after doing it, I mean, I'm not trying to be sanguine about it or say that, focus on the positive here or anything like that, because people I do think are being actually hurt. But it's not like them nuking Roe was the end of the discussion, because this backlash is occurring. I mean, you want, from the pro-choice perspective, you want the backlash to occur to such a degree that you eventually get the court back. But that's not a, you know, one election proposition. So I don't want to lose that seat. But I do think it does take away some of the intensity of this conversation.
All right. Well, let's end on a happier, lighter note, Bill. I've picked up my pop culture game lately. I just finished Regime, the Kate Winslet vehicle.
Nothing about.
It's HBO. I just finished Ripley, the take on the talented Mr. Ripley on Netflix. And one episode left to go on Manhunt, the Apple TV project based on the book by the same name. Bill, are you partaking in any of this, or what are you watching these days?
I know none of those things. The only thing that my wife and I watched together to completion was the last season of Only Murders in the Building, which I liked.
What's it called?
Only Murders in the Building, the Steve Martin, okay. Martin Short, Selena Gomez.
I've heard good things.
Yeah, I mean, is it like the greatest thing I've seen in my life? No, is it? But it's solid. Solid murder mystery.
Where can I get this?
That's Hulu. Okay. You probably season three, maybe not my favorite of the three seasons. You know, they're definitely stretching things out. Maybe more plot holes in season three than the other ones, but still, it's still fun. And it's more and more cameos, you know, especially Meryl Streep, Paul Rudd, Matthew Broderick, Jane Lynch, you know, Andrea Martin, you know, they just get great people to do it, and it's clear that they're having fun doing it. So it's worthwhile.
Very cool. All right, well, I need to put that on the list. Always a pleasure, Bill. Anything else you want to plug? We talked about your piece on the do you know the title? How can people find that?
Well, it's up on the WashingtonMonthly.com site right now. I never
know the titles of mine, yeah.
It was.
We'll link Biden. To it in the show notes. It's about why Biden
isn't talking about Trump's hush money trial for good reason. You can also see the last edition of my newsletter, which talked about Mike Johnson and Ukraine. That's all up on the WashingtonMonthly.com website. The newsletter is also available on Substack.
Cool. Well, read my piece. Read my stuff at the Daily Beast. Follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. We'll see you back here in the DMZ next week.
Take care.